Welcome to the GBC Sermon Podcast, a weekly podcast from Gaimia Baptist Church in Sydney, Australia. I'm Mark Rader, senior pastor here at GBC, and I hope you hear the invitation of God in this message today. As we continue to explore John's unique perspective on following Jesus, we turn to yet another I Am passage. I am the Good Shepherd in John chapter 10, where we learn again that following Jesus begins with Jesus.
Good morning. Good to have you here this morning. I trust you've got plans for the day and that they haven't been too impacted by what's happened with COVID. Thanks, Marbs, for being with us. Really great project that we've had the opportunity to support for a number of years now. It's really humbling to just to hear again how engaged they are, how kind of at the coalface those churches are. Showing love to those that they formerly hated. Just remarkable act of God in bringing forgiveness to their hearts, but also extending the grace of God to others. I have taken part in the three-day challenge, the rice and pasta, lentil and can of tuna for 3 days. My youngest daughter Lucy and I kind of did it together, which was helpful. Looking forward to the conversations we're going to have with our evening congregation around what that felt like. Lucy was at school this week and, you know, had like just a bowl of rice one day. And so her friends are like, well, what are you doing? Like, don't your parents love you? She explained what she was doing. And yeah, I think on Friday someone asked, you know, so do you feel like a refugee? And Lucy's like, yeah, sure. When I live in my 4-bedroom house and, you know, I'm on public transport going to a very nice school. And like, I was kind of impressed that she was able to kind of make the jump to, yeah, no, this is nothing at all like a refugee's life, but a learning opportunity as well. So we've had some good conversations, looking forward to that. Tonight, in particular, as we continue to work out what it means for us to give sacrificially and be a part of that larger work of God. Well, we are continuing our series in John's Gospel, where we are paying attention to John's unique take on what it means to follow Jesus. John's Gospel, of course, is quite different in terms of its outline and structure and points of emphasis to, say, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And so we figured there'd be something for us to focus on about how he describes following Jesus. And by paying attention to that, we might learn something for our own discipleship. And in today's passage in chapter 10, we come across yet another I am statement. So one of John's unique takes is that he fills his gospel with Jesus' statements where he uses these quite provocative metaphors. Jesus, for instance, says that he is the light of the world, or that he is the bread of life, or that he is the vine. And here he takes on a fairly familiar Old Testament image when he says, I am the good shepherd. He also says that I am the gate. We'll look at that in a little bit, but I'm going to be focused primarily on the idea of being the shepherd, because in reality, shepherd and gate were kind of the same metaphor. So in antiquity, a sheepfold or a sheep pen that the shepherds might use was essentially a stone-walled enclosure with an opening. The opening didn't have a door or a gate in it. Instead, the shepherd functioned like the gate. So once all the sheep were in, the shepherd would lay down in the doorway and kind of keep predators out and the sheep in. So when Jesus talks about being the shepherd and talks about being the gate, it's essentially the one metaphor. The metaphor is, as I said, really quite well known. It's one of the most well-known psalms, Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, which speaks of the tenderness, of the provision, of the care that the Lord has for his people, for each of us. But the image of a shepherd is actually far more commonly used in Scripture to talk about leadership. So whether you refer to the passages in Samuel or in Psalms, where David is described as shepherding the flock of God, being the shepherd for the people of God, or whether you look at passages like Ezekiel chapter 34, where the prophet critiques quite harshly the leadership of the day, calling them false shepherds, showing the various ways in which they have not led the people of God particularly well. There's a kind of a convoluted, full passage in Zechariah 14 where the prophet takes on the task of a shepherd for a flock that won't be led, and there are false shepherds, and he breaks staves, and all sorts of stuff is kind of taking place. Peter, in his first epistle, talks about sheep, shepherds, and uses that to speak about those who are in leadership in the church of God. This is kind of one of the dominant ways in which shepherding is described in Scripture, which does kind of beg the question, what exactly is going on in this passage? Jesus, as it starts in verse 1, he's still speaking to the Pharisees, right? Very truly, I tell you, Pharisees. And so it's worth just pausing before we look at this passage in a little bit of detail to reflect on what's happened in chapter 9. Because at first glance, what happens in chapter 9 and what happens in chapter 10 seem to be completely and utterly distinct, but Jesus is speaking through that context. So chapter 9 of John contains another one of Jesus' signs, where he heals a man who was born blind. Jesus sees the man. He and his disciples have a little conversation about that. He spits on the ground and makes some mud, wipes it on the man's eyes, and tells him to go and wash in the pool of Siloam. So the man goes off and he washes his eyes in that pool, and his sight is restored. And the rest of the chapter, though, is really taken up with this almost farcical inquisition that follows. So Jesus disappears from the story. If you have a Bible that has the words of Jesus in red, you might notice that most of chapter 9 contains no red letters. Jesus acts at the beginning and then shows up again at the end. But in the middle of it is this, as I said, almost farcical inquisition. Because the man who had been blind, no longer blind, decides to go home. And his neighbors see him and they say, you look like that bloke who was blind and used to beg here all the time. Like you really look like him. And he's like, well, that's because I am. And they're like, what happened? He says, well, a man named Jesus made some mud and put it in my eyes and told me to wash, and I did, and now I can see. Which is utterly gobsmacking to his neighbors. And you need to realize, I mean, we're used to medical miracles all the time, right? We read about them every other day. We're currently living in the middle of one to some degree. The production of vaccines is a medical marvel. But for the people in the Old Testament and the New Testament, the restoration of sight was next level miraculous. So in the Old Testament, right, and there aren't very many healing miracles, but of the healing miracles that you find, the restoration of sight never happens. The closest you get is when Elisha temporarily blinds an army and then their sight is restored. But the sight of the blind is something that was reserved for the time when the Messiah would come. So Isaiah speaks of the day when the lame would leap like deer and the deaf would have their ears opened and the eyes of the blind would be opened. This is kind of this remarkable messianic activity. And so when this man just casually shows up and says, oh yeah, some guy caused me to see again, they can't believe it. And so they bring in the religious leaders, the Pharisees and the scribes and whatnot, and they begin to question this fellow. And they ask him what happened, and he tells them again. And they can't believe it, and we're told an extra detail. And that is that Jesus had healed this man on the Sabbath. And I suppose because making mud is work and washing it off is work, they cannot reconcile how anybody who breaks the law would also be able to do an act of God who gave the law that they just broke. So they haul this guy's parents in and they say to his parents, is this your son? They're like, yes. What happened? And they are so scared of the Jewish leaders who we're told were threatening to kick anybody who acknowledged Jesus out of the synagogue that they basically throw their son under the bus. And they say, he's old enough to speak for himself, so just ask him. And so they haul him back in. And this man who was begging his whole life basically takes on the religious leaders. And they have this kind of back and forth where finally they kick him out of the synagogue because he basically says, surely this man is from God. And they're like, get out. Jesus finds him. At the end of the passage, Jesus finds him and basically says, do you believe in the Son of Man? And he's like, I'd like to know who it is. And Jesus says, it's me. And the man says, I believe, and worships him. And then Jesus speaks to the religious leaders, and he speaks about, not surprisingly, he knows a good teaching point when he sees one, about spiritual blindness, right? A perfect, perfect transition. Here's a man who was physically blind and has been restored in his physical sight, but has demonstrated spiritual sight while the religious leaders are demonstrating spiritual blindness. Perfect. And then Jesus completely pivots to an utterly different metaphor. So in chapter 10, he just leaves the spiritual blindness to one side. He never returns to the man who had been born blind. Instead, Jesus begins to talk about being a shepherd and about the sheep and about sheep pens and about gates and about all of these sorts of things. Is it any wonder in verse 6 that the Pharisees had no idea what he was talking about? And yet, there are some really interesting connections between these two. I don't think this is a long time afterwards because of the connections. So first of all, Jesus is speaking to the Pharisees. He is speaking to the leaders of the community. He is speaking to the shepherds of the flock. And these shepherds have been deciding who gets to come into the sheep pen and who gets to stay out on the basis of their spiritual blindness to who Jesus is. And Jesus is kind of flipping the tables on where leadership exists. He's speaking about himself as the one through whom people enter into the people of God. And by acknowledging him, that's the only way in. He speaks of the life that is to come. And so this is a bit of a critique of the religious leaders. But you also have this really interesting example in the man who had been blind of someone who heard the voice of Jesus and followed him. When this man washed his eyes and could see again, returns home, and basically people ask him, who did this? All he could say is, Jesus, but I have no idea what he looks like. Because when he was before me, I was blind. All he could do was recognize the voice of Jesus. So there are some little connections here, which then lead into this metaphor that Jesus begins to expound upon and to amplify following in verse 7. So he uses this opening image of the sheepfold and the shepherd and the sheep who he knows by name and who follow after him. But there are two things I want to emphasize in this passage that I think are critical for us. And the first of them is to simply notice, and again, I'm indebted to Sean Kim and his study on following Jesus for this insight, but I want to draw our attention to the focus on the work of Jesus almost to the exclusion of the sheep. There is almost nothing for the sheep to do in this passage. So just listen to what Jesus goes on to say, starting in verse 7 as he continues this. And listen for the work of Jesus. Very truly I tell you, I am the gate for the sheep. I'm the one who lies down the door, who makes sure that they are protected and kept safe. All who have come before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep have not listened to them. I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. They will come in and go out through the gate that I am and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that they may have life and life to the full. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. This becomes the dominant example of what the shepherd does. The hired hand is not the shepherd and does not own the sheep. So when he sees the wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. Sounds a bit like the blind man's parents, wouldn't you say? Then the wolf attacks the flock and scatters it. The man runs away because he's a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep. My sheep know me, just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father. And I lay down my life for the sheep. I have other sheep that are not of this pen, perhaps a reference to the Gentiles. They too will listen to my voice, and they shall be one flock and one shepherd. The reason my Father loves me is that I lay down my life, only to take it back up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down, authority to take it up again. This command I received from my Father. That is all about Jesus, isn't it? I will lay down my life for the sheep. And I do it because that's the command I've been given by my Father. That's my purpose. That's my mission. That's my task. And this is why the Father and I love each other, because I am doing the will of the Father, and He has given to me the authority to lay my life down, to take my life back up. Because normally, if the shepherd dies, that's bad news for the flock, wouldn't you say? We have a hint that something more is going on here. Because normally, if the shepherd dies, then the wolves who killed the shepherd are now even hungrier for lamb, right? There's something more taking place here, but Jesus will usher his sheep into the abundant, full life. This is the task of Jesus. And it's all about him. Because notice this, Jesus does not, at any point in this passage, give his sheep something to do. Jesus doesn't say, for instance, "I am the good shepherd. I lay down my life for my sheep, and my sheep do the same." He doesn't say that, does he? There is no ethical imperative that comes out of John chapter 10. No moral command, no example for us to follow. Jesus doesn't say, "This is how I live my life, and this is how I expect my followers to live their lives." That's not what's going on here at all. Now, Jesus gets there, doesn't he? In John chapter 13, the night before he is betrayed, he washes his disciples' feet, takes on the form of the lowest servant, and washes their feet. And then when he comes back to the table and sits down, he looks at his disciples and says, "Now that I, your master and teacher, have washed your feet, you should do likewise." The ethical imperative comes, the moral command comes, the model to follow does come. But right here, it is solidly on Jesus. In fact, he makes this quite extraordinary claim to exclusivity, right? He doesn't call himself a good shepherd, does he? He's the good shepherd. In a verse that keeps Bible scholars up at night, if you ever want to know what keeps a Bible scholar up at night, what ties them in knots, it's verse 8. "All who have come before me," he says, "are thieves and robbers." Which is all well and good if you think that the only ones who have come before Jesus are the Pharisees, but the people who have come before Jesus include people like John the Baptist, Elijah, Isaiah, David, Moses. And the thought of these poor biblical scholars that Jesus might be saying that those great examples of faith are robbers and thieves, just, it messes with them no end. Fascinating part of commentaries. They all get stuck on it. But I think what Jesus is getting at, of course, is I think he's just using hyperbole. He's exaggerating to make a point of sorts, isn't he? He's not saying, "I am a good shepherd. I come in a long line of good shepherds. There's any number of good shepherds. Just make sure the shepherd you follow is a good one." No, he's saying, "I am the good shepherd." And think about it. If you had had John the Baptist and Jesus there, and they each said, "Follow me," who would we be better off following? Well, Jesus. Not because John the Baptist was a slouch or a poor person or of lousy character or wouldn't be particularly valuable to us, but because Jesus is Jesus. He's the one who can lead to eternal life. He's the one who can give us the full life. He's the one by whom we are saved, not John the Baptist. And to be fair, John the Baptist has already demonstrated that, given the choice, he would encourage his followers to begin following Jesus. If we had the decision between Isaiah and Jesus, if those were our two options, I think we would follow Jesus. Again, saying nothing about Isaiah, a wonderful, faithful servant of God. If we had Jesus and Moses, that probably ups the ante to its highest. I mean, Moses is the one who spoke with God, a friend of God, the one whose face glowed because he spent so much time in the presence of God, the one who had been given by the Lord's own hands the law, who facilitated the covenant. If we had the choice between following Moses and following Jesus, we would follow Jesus. Because a friend of God is wonderful, but the Son of God is the real thing. And Jesus is no more saying that Moses or David or Jeremiah or Ezekiel or John the Baptist are thieves and robbers and should be denigrated, right? He is simply saying that he is the good shepherd, the only voice worth following. Which brings us, of course, to the question of what is our task? If this is all about Jesus, what's the task? What does it look like for us to follow Jesus, who is the good shepherd? And it comes down to one thing, and one thing only. The responsibility that we have from this passage is actually found in the section that was read for us. Right? Verses 1 to 6, verse 4. When he has brought out all his own sheep who he has called by name, he goes on ahead of him, of them, and his sheep follow him because they know his voice. The task of discipleship in John's gospel in chapter 10 is to recognize Jesus' voice and follow him. That's all. The doing will come. But do you notice the pattern here? In John chapter 1, the centerpiece of following Jesus was simply to spend time with him. Spend time with Jesus. The doing will come. When we follow the light of the world, the whole purpose is that we might know the Father. And once we know the Father, then we will understand his mission and take part in it. But the goal of discipleship is simply to know the Father. And here again, it is simply to recognize the voice of Jesus and to follow him. And there's an element of that which is, of course, personal, right? Where we spend time in the Word of God, where we become familiar with his words and with his ways in order that we might recognize his activity in the world. There's an element of this where we engage in this, in the act of prayer, not just speaking to the Lord, but also then stopping and listening and asking what he might be saying to us. And I don't want to suggest that those are not valuable things, because they very much are. But I want to draw your attention to a particular feature of this section. And that is that Jesus speaks in the plural. Jesus calls his sheep by name. There is an individuality that Jesus knows each of us. But when Jesus speaks of the sheep who follow him, he's speaking about a group of people. They hear my voice and they follow me. And one of the best ways that we learn to recognize the voice of Jesus is actually in community. We gain familiarity with Jesus by spending time with him and in community. I don't know how many of you have sets of twins in your life. Often twins, like I've got nephews who are twins. I still can't always tell them apart. There are twins who are friends of my daughter's. I can't tell them apart. I just call them mate or whatever it is, right? When I was in Canada, I was involved in youth ministry. There was a set of twins, Daryl and Nolan. And when I first met them, I thought nobody, not even their own mother, could tell them apart. There's just no possible way that anyone could spot the difference. But by the end of my 4 years in ministry there, I couldn't believe that you couldn't tell them apart. They were so obviously different. I could pick the difference between Daryl and Nolan on the phone at the end of 4 years. Now, what had happened? Well, two things. One, I'd seen them every Friday and every Sunday for 4 years. That helps. But I'd also done that in a community where you kind of got to talk to other people and say, is that Daryl? No, it's Nolan. How can you tell? And they'd give you their tips on how you could tell them apart. And you're like, oh, you're right. His nose does have a little dent in it. I never noticed that. Oh, look, when he smiles, he's got a dimple on the right side. I didn't know that. Oh, they have completely different hairstyle. Like it's the whole kind of thing. You learn kind of by sharing your corporate experience and by growing familiar with. Our task is to recognize the voice of Jesus and to follow him. And part of that is done as we grow familiar with him, and part of that is done together. So together, we have the opportunity to share how we have heard and recognized the voice of Jesus so that we can begin to identify the patterns of his communication that speak most deeply to us in order that we might follow the Good Shepherd, the one who has laid down his life for us. The doing will come. The work of following Jesus begins with spending time with him. It begins with knowing the Father. It begins with being able to recognize his voice. This is the work of discipleship.
Before the ethical imperatives or moral models of following Jesus, there is a simple directive for those who want to follow him. Learn to recognize his voice and follow. This familiarity comes through individual disciplines, but also in community as we learn together to hear his voice and follow him. I hope you've been encouraged this week to learn to listen to Jesus as we follow him together. And don't forget, you can join us for Sunday services at gbconline.org.au at 9:30 Australian Eastern Standard Time, or visit our website at guymeabaptist.org.au for on-site service times. Thanks for joining us again this week, and until next time, God bless.